about the same time, the transmission hypothesis is doubtful. This was dependent on the existence of synapses. Transmission hypothesis, this is a slightly misleading name. It sounds more general than it is. It's really only to do with the supposed transmission across a little tiny gap. Yeah,
from one nerve cell to another.
Yeah, the synaptic gap.
Yes.
And of course, if you've got synapses, then you can look at the transmission hypothesis. If the synapses don't exist, what he says here is, I analysed transmission whereby signals are believed to pass from one part of the nervous system to another, and concluded that the view that transmission was chemical, formulated in detail by Professor Sir Bernard Katz, 1969 was his inaugural lecture on that, I think, contained too many unproved and unprovable assumptions for the theory as a whole to be acceptable. And 1991, well, it was a long time in the future, from our point of view, re-examination of the vesicle hypothesis. That's one of his four papers published later on, looking at the whole concept of the
transmission.
Yes. Yeah. So far, no one has addressed my objections to the theory. I felt it a duty to propose a new hypothesis. That was also published in 1991, mm-hmm. Another one of these papers. Now, between 1980 and 85, various other things happened. There was Parrish replied. Reviewed the living cell. Harold wrote simple micromanipulation and microdissection. Yes, a Quaker Club Journal article, and gave a talk on that typical kind of thing. In this case, at the Quaker Club, about the lack of need for fancy equipment. Really, you make your own stuff. And vegetarianism. He wrote an article on vegetarianism. 1982. Some questions not answered by electron microscopists was published. Also, there were some books published around this time, Broad and Wade, Betrayers of Truth, I got down to 1982. Yeah. 1985. Right, at the end of 1985, we have the first book of a new series, the first paper of a new series, The Anatomical Synapse in Mammals by Light and Electron Microscopy. And this was the next stage on these, after the cellular structure of the mammalian nervous system.
Yes. What I did in that, you see, I showed that the synapse, the anatomical synapse, is an artifact. But what I didn't want to do is I didn't want to put it in the title. So I just said the anatomical synapse by light and electron microscopy. I didn't put in the title that I had concluded it was an artifact.
Right. In other words, the title is subtly misleading.
Yeah, it's not misleading.
It's an edited title.
Yes.
Okay. Also about this time, you saw M.I.M. Noble about Huxley and Hansen's sliding filament hypothesis of muscle fibers.
Yeah.
And 10 years later, you decide to write a joint paper when Brian Freeman comes up with not identical, but
other criticisms.
Numbers of criticisms about this particular hypothesis. And anyway, so here we go. So 1986 was your next big book, The Cellular Structure of the Mammalian Nervous System, which you could view as being a rediscovery of von Virchow's theory, but that's perhaps a bit unfair. And it includes, as we said, material on staining, both the colour stuff and the silvery stuff.
Yes.
And concludes, there's a whole lot of, the whole lot of stuff. The first chapter is called Landmarks in Cell Biology. It includes huge sections of things like mitochondria and Golgi bodies, which to the casual observer looks like a summary of what's discovered, but in fact is meant as a kind of debunking. And then there's methods of studying neural structure, which includes these various dubious techniques.
Well, what I've done is that I think it's absolutely central that people should understand the methods by which the things they believe were discovered. Because a lot of people seem somehow to think that what they believe in is independent of how it was found out.
Yes. In other words, well, it's not surprising, is it? It's the way it's presented in books.
I know, but...
And if you want to pass your exam, that's not a sensible attitude to it.
Absolutely. But I mean, for a learned book, people actually don't know. If you stop the average person in the street and say, how do you know that I'm an average biologist, how do you know that the DNA is in the nuclei, the majority of them would say, who know about it, would say, oh, by subcellular fractionation. And you say to them, have you ever considered what happens during subcellular fractionation? They haven't.
Okay. The point there being that it's the density that matters or something, isn't it? In other words, if you do subcellular fractionation of anything, really...
Yes, right, it separates according to density. Right.
Yeah, so the things can migrate all over the place.
Yes.
Like the sandy stuff go to the bottom, wherever it was in life.
Right? That's right. Yeah. And also, ions and things which activate and inhibit enzymes can move easily. So what you find at the end doesn't reflect what it started at the beginning.
Right. Now, there are another 12 chapters to with cellular structure, including the practical recommendations. There are some appendices, including one on specificity of staining procedures.
Mm-hmm.
It's too much to go through there briefly. It ends up with unsatisfactory terms, another one of these collections of evasive expressions and a few naive questions at the end.
Yeah.
Incidentally, the same year, Cohn's False Prophets was published.
Oh, yes.
So was Intellectual Suppression, edited by, among others, Brian Martin.
Yes.
There was also a book by Michael Gold called A Conspiracy of Cells on HeLa, H-E-L-A, Henrietta Lacks cells.
Ah, yes, yes. But that was for a different reason, because they got into all the tissue cultures all over the world.
That's right, a scandalous situation.
Yes.
And also two Germans got a Nobel Prize for so-called ionic channels.
That's right.
What do you want to say about your big book, apart from the fact it didn't sell very well? Cellular Structure. Do you have any regrets?
Well, first of all, it was heavily overpriced because it was camera ready. Heavily overpriced, and there was virtually no attempt to get it reviewed. But the two people who did review, one was neutral, the other was very, very laudatory.
Who was the laudatory one?
He's a professor of biochemistry at Galway.
Galway, yeah, right. I mean, that's listed in somewhere in your writings, is it, probably?
Probably.
I remember you saying, mentioning there were two reviews.
Yes, but I mean, he should have been, I mean, you understand it presents such a different view of the brain that
right.
It should have been reviewed in any of the brain journals, and it wasn't.
Right. At the end of it, you haven't got a model of, I know you, whenever at your talks, you always say that you don't know what, you're not willing to discuss consciousness, thinking, that kind of thing, or
yeah,
the soul,
correct.
The spirit.
Yeah, yeah.
So presumably your view of the brain is not... It's just the biology of it, so to speak. It doesn't
yes.
attempt to explain what goes on
no,
in it.
No, absolutely.
If
not.
Anything, I mean...
Yes, absolutely
right.
not. Yes.
Okay. So, do you have any more comments to say about it?
Well, I was very annoyed that it wasn't reviewed, because, I mean, if I'm right, an awful lot of people are wasting their time. And I've dealt with some very important questions. We did original experiments which nobody's ever done, you know, to scan the whole brain and see how much of it stains, with each of the stains which are supposed to stain specific kinds of nerve cells.
You did the whole brain?
Yes.
You didn't?
Different parts of the brain.
Yeah, right. And this appeared in your colour film came out next year, in 1987, Effects of Staining.
Yes, but that came out of the book, actually. It came out of the book on the millennium.
Who was the chap shown in this, actually? Was that David Jarman? There was a kind of thinning on top.
Yes.
Chap shown. That was Dave Jarman.
Yes, I think so.
I wondered, because it didn't look quite like him. How did your film go down? Cellular Structure of the Human Brain.
Oh, tremendous hostility wherever I showed it.
Did you manage to show it anywhere?
Oh, I showed it lots of places. You see, because of the Physiological Society, Biochemical Society, Society for Experimental Biology, the European Society of Neurochemistry. I was a member of all these, and they couldn't stop
it. When you showed it, you had a sort of evening, and your name was down there, and it was written up and so on, and people came along. You know, it was advertised months beforehand. Sort of.
Oh, yes, well, you send an abstract.
Yeah.
And
I was just trying to get the feel of what the actual event was like.
What it was like, for example, at the Physiological Society, I showed it. There was a classroom about this size.
Mm.
It was packed out. You couldn't get in. I showed at the Cambridge Biochemical Society, which was packed out. There were about 200 people in the room, and I had to show it twice because there was a huge queue outside.
Right, and it was advertised beforehand in the usual timetable system.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Harold Film and World, a new film, so on.
No, it was just you give papers for 10 minutes, and it just had the structure of the main brain
okay.
film.
And you showed that in... Did you also show that in US and France
yes,
and things?
Yes, I showed all that.
Oh, and you went around yourself with it?
Yeah.
In a film can?
Yes, I've got the films... I've got film and cassette.
Can you just imagine you turning up?
Oh, no, sorry, that coloured one, I've only got cassette.
Right.
The first one I've got films in.
So... and you got... Presumably people came up afterwards. What do people say to you afterwards?
Well, most of them were just very angry. I mean, that's what happened.
Well, how can you present such rubbish sort of thing?
That's right. You know, absolute rubbish. You know. He doesn't know that such thing. But when I went to Australia recently, you know, the first day I arrived there, I was absolutely wrecked, you know, but it was a long airline.
Right, this was in last year, 1995,
yes.
Of October or something.
That's right, it was...
Or November, something like that, wasn't it?
Yes, something like that, September. I can't remember. But when I got to Australia, I mean, it was a packed meeting.
You took that video with you, didn't you? In fact, I remember helping you make it.
Yeah.
With your complete works on it.
Yeah.
The complete filmed works.
But I mean, it was half of the people simply tremendously hostile.
Mm.
You can't imagine actually what it feels like. I mean, I wake up at night sweating, thinking what a damn fool I was for doing this, because you know, everybody thought they were going to get the classical structure of the brain, you know, the neurons and the neuroglia and all that sort of thing. And when I tell them that, you know, there's only one kind of neuroglia, they get really quite upset. But I mean,
they didn't actually throw anything at you?
No, but some were very rude.
Were you very rude back?
No. I've sometimes been a bit scientifically rude.
You didn't call them kangaroos or something? I don't know if there's any.
No.
I see. How disappointing. Right. Anyway, never mind. 1987. So that presumably went on. Well, we're back in 1987, so now you're back aged 57.
Mm.
An advanced age, indeed. Colour film effects are staying. Fraud versus carelessness, letters in nature. How to make medical research more successful. This was your other paper or letter on no, technology not being...
This was two articles in the practitioner.
Right. And also the effect of hematoxylin and eosin, Palmgren's and osmic acid procedures on the dimensions and appearance of isolated rabbit medullary neurons in the journal for things with long titles.
Well, yeah. I'll tell you about that. That's a very interesting thing. You see, everybody in the world who's a histologist knows that cells shrink when you stain them.
Yeah.
Everybody knows it. But they don't like you to tell them.
They don't like to admit the figures. Okay, 1988, your second receptors paper, Critique of Current Views on Receptors and a New General Theory of Receptor Location and Action in Vivo.
Yes.
I've got a copy of all of certainly those four papers. Can you summarise that one? Because I can't make any sense.
Oh yes, receptors is the biggest industry nowadays in biology. Indeed, Sir James Black got the Nobel Prize for receptors.
Ah, you spoke to him, didn't you? He saw one of your papers when he wrote.
No, that was different. No, Sir James Black was recently.
Oh, sorry.
Horbin showed him my book.
The one on the 72 one, on uncertainty.
No, the
Living Cell.
That was before I got it published. It was a case for new paradigms.
Oh, right, okay. So he got his Nobel Prize recently.
Well, while he was actually reading it, the Nobel Prize was announced, and I didn't have the courage to ask him his comments.
I see. Okay, so that was James Black. What do you say about Critique of Current Views on Receptors and the New General Theory?
Well, what's very... Everybody in the world, except me, believes that drugs, transmitters, hormones, toxins act by receptors.
Okay, by receptors you mean in the synapse sense?
Yes, they believe that, no, along the synapse are special kinds of substances called receptors which react. So when you have adrenaline, there's a specific adrenaline receptor.
You don't mean, sorry, do you just mean in the synaptic gap or along the length of the thing?
No, they're all over, but they are concentrated. There are a lot more on the synaptic.
But they believe that they all relate to nerves. I mean, they're to do with synapses.
No. You have receptors to all kinds of all cells.
Right. So they've generalised it to everything. Yeah, yeah. So receptors has now widened to not just receptors across the synaptic gap.
It's widened a long time ago.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's receptors. They could be anywhere. They could be in the tongue or.
Oh yes, I mean the
or something.
Yes.
Kidney, liver.
That's right.
All right. So what was your new general theory? How did you criticise
it briefly? My new general theory is that, you see, a very large number of these receptors have been isolated, and Well, sequenced. In other words, their structure is known.
When you say that, you're being tongue-in-cheek, are you?
No, they believe they have.
Yeah, but you don't believe they have. So you're being tongue-in-cheek.
No. Let me follow the argument. They have found them, and they're large. You see, what they regard as receptors are very large. They're an average of 3 times as wide as a cell membrane.
Presumably they'd have to be just to fit big molecules in, wouldn't they?
Yes, but they actually have got the molecules they believe them to be.
Right.
And they are 3 times the width of... So I said, well, why can't we see them on the cell membrane, where you can see the cell membrane by electron microscopy?
Right.
And nobody has ever answered that question.
Okay.
And there's one only they've ever seen, that's the acetylcholine receptor. And I pointed out there are literally millions of substances which have got receptors. So you should see not just one lump of one size, which you do see the acetylcholine receptor. You should see a Himalayan mountain range with all different...
Right. How do you know that millions of substances have got receptors? Because they have...
They say they have, I don't.
Right, you mean anything that has an effect is supposed is deemed to have a
Precisely.
Receptor?
Precisely. Mm. Not everything. A few things like alcohol and anesthetics.
Well, when you say they've sequenced it and so on, you're being tongue-in-cheek, aren't you?
They've sequenced what they believe to be the receptor. Yeah,
but you're being tongue-in-cheek, aren't you? Because you can't possibly believe that they've actually... How have they made this mistake of finding...
Well,
Well,
I'll tell you how they've done, because what they have done is they have got substances which they believe act on the receptors, you see. They mixed up, if you take a radioactive substance which you believe acts on the receptor, example, they haven't done this, but it's a rather complicated, so I'll simplify. If you believe adrenaline is a receptor, you get radioactive adrenaline, you would... add it to the tissue, mash up the tissue, and extract the radioactive product, you see. And since this is a receptor, you believe it's a receptor, then the substance you've got out, you then study its chemistry.
Right, so you... Okay, so you do all this mashing up and you end up with a radioactive...
concentrate,
yeah.
Which they believe contains the receptor.
And then you analyse it and you try and work out...
Yes.
And you find... If you're lucky, multiple copies of some chemical, and you say, right, this is a receptor.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Now, the reason why I believe it couldn't possibly be, because everybody agrees that by transmission electron microscopy, you cannot see that receptor.
Right. Is that your only reason for disbelieving in them?
No. The second reason is that they would be lots of different heights.
Yes, right. So that's a variation of your... scaling, one of your arguments against electron microscopy is that you compare it with light microscopy and sort of scale it up and down.
Yes.
And people aren't bothering to do this, and so all sorts of absurdities get through.
That's right.
This is a variation of the thing you're saying, that they're taking one little thing in isolation, and if they were serious and applied it to everything, it would be impossible.
That's right. There wouldn't be room for them all.
Yeah, right.
But nobody has ever addressed this question. This is why I put it in a list of questions. Why do we not see them on transmission electron microscopy?
So I take it your new general theory of receptor location just doesn't believe in receptors at all. It's something different from that.
It's much simpler than that.
So it's not a theory of receptor location at all. It's a new theory replacing receptors.
Yes. But it's a slight extension of the word. If, for example, you took a piece of leather and you took a piece of butter and a piece of a raisin...
Yes, I think we've been through this before, actually, with dough, actually.
It doesn't matter. If you took three different, totally different materials, and you reacted with each of the large range of chemicals on your
bench. I know we're going to say they all react to some extent.
Yes.
Unfortunately, I remember you telling this before, and I still was unable to see what you were getting at.
I'm saying is that supposing we took a piece of dough, it will react to a different extent with a large number of different compounds. You wouldn't say they're different receptors.
So what?
I think that the living tissue is a very heterogeneous material, and lots of materials will react with it.
Yeah, so what?
So you don't need a receptor for each of them, that's the point. They think you need a receptor for each, if you like...
Right, so you think there may be some receptors?
No, I don't. I think there are no receptors. I think the material itself acts as a receptor.
Hmm.
Just as a piece of butter will act as a receptor to all organic solvents.
Okay. All right, let's leave it at that. Okay, 1988, the Vice-Chancellor imposes voluntary, in quotes, early retirement, and the Unity Lab is... Well, they try to close it. They don't actually close it, because Horobin pays some money for about 4 years or something, I think.
Yes, that's correct.
But they succeeded not paying you any money. Yes. And that goes, that kind of drags on in an unpleasant way. But nevertheless, you fight back somewhat.
Yes.
And you get them to pay for putting in a new plumbing system, I think, for example.
Yes.
But anyway, right, 1990, your new book, Atlas of the Cellular Structure of the Human Nervous System.
91,
I think. Yeah. I think it's dated. I don't know. Anyway, it's a joint product with you and Jarman.
Yes.
And I seem to remember that it was soon withdrawn from the catalogue by the publishers, apparently contrary to their contract or something like that. They were supposed to keep them in print for
No, you're giving yourself. Right. The Atlas is still in print and is still selling. I published at the same year...
It was withdrawn from their catalogue, is what I said, not that it had been withdrawn.
Now, what happened was, I told you, was that there were other books which were published before then, which appeared in their catalogue, and ours didn't.
Yeah.
And when I questioned them about it, they said it was going to appear in some other catalogues, but I didn't follow it up. I don't know whether it did or not.
Okay. It was withdrawn from the catalogue anyway, prematurely. Isn't that a fair statement?
Well, I would have thought so, yes.
Yeah. What was in it? I've seen this book once, I think. It was a collection of photos.
Well, what it is, we've taken the whole of the human nervous system, except for the retina and the peripheral nerves, you see, because we couldn't get those off from post-mortems.
You're touching your elbow there. That's a peripheral nerve, example.
Yes, okay. That's the ulnar nerve.
Yeah.
And we took the whole... And what we did is, because we've shown that histology, staining, causes such shrinkage and artifacts, we took out the cells without any staining and looked at them by phase contrast microscopy, which enables you to look at them in the nearest to life you can possibly get them.
I say, is this somewhat similar to what Vesalius did? If Vesalius had a microscope, he could have done this, couldn't he? I mean,
yes.
Because he had a picture of the nervous system, the brain.
Yes.
With...
That's right. Well, that was macro, you see.
Yeah, but I mean, so it's not very different from that.
No, except that what we did is we teased them by the technique of Houdin, you see, which nobody thought of doing.
What did you conclude? I mean, was the object to conclude anything? Was it just to produce photos showing things?
Well, it's a bit crafty, actually. For one thing, we put in the nucleolar membrane, lots of pictures of it.
Yes, I'm sure. Did you label it as such?
No, yes, of course.
Right. And did you have the nucleolonema in it?
Yes. Well, we didn't describe the nucleonema, somebody else had described it.
Someone else had? Yeah. How could they describe that without acknowledging nucleoluses?
Oh, everybody agrees there's nucleolus. What they don't agree is the nucleolar membrane.
How can it be a nucleus without a membrane? Am I missing something here?
No, I agree with you, that's the point I made. but the fact is...
They think there's a round thing floating around in the nucleus without a boundary to it.
Precisely.
Like the great red spot in Jupiter or something.
Yeah.
God, how bizarre. And inside it's got...
The nucleolonema, yes.
It's supposed to have funny things that change shapes.
Yeah, that was our finding.
That it changes shapes. That's not just an artifact of light, the thing being tiny and it not being able to make it out properly.
No. It doesn't, because I've got two photographs. Only two, actually.
You don't think that's the DNA, do you, by any chance?
Which is
wiggling around inside it, with a nucleolonema.
I do.
You do? Oh, good.
I put forward a theory to Nature. I wrote a paper about 20 years ago and they wouldn't publish it.
Am I right in saying that part of the motive of this atlas was to smuggle in your ideas, you know, in other words, presumably it included your view of the brain and the as well as...
Some people have thought that. It's not quite like that. The fact is that I showed, with David Jarman, all the cells we could see. You see?
Right.
Now, we did not see astrocytes, oligodendrocytes, or microglia. And one or two of the people who read it have attacked us for not showing them. And I said we didn't show them because we didn't see them, ever.
I see. So a reviewer might have said, who was not sympathetic, would have said that they haven't even discovered, they haven't even shown examples of the astrocytes or whatever.
That's right.
Yes, I see. Yes, I see.
But we, in fact, showed every element we saw.
And that included the granular material made up largely of mitochondria, or whatever it is.
Yes, we showed, we put the illustration of that, which nobody believes in either.
Right, an illustration without comment of what they contained in detail, apart from...
We don't know what they...
Yeah, right. Well, don't know.
So. No, I put on one of the pictures, I put the granular material, a large number of mitochondria, or the granular material consists of a large number of mitochondria.
What, without anything else?
That's right, yes.
I mean, it's just mitochondria?
No, there are the grains as well, but the mitochondria we identify.
Okay, you mean mitochondria make up a high proportion of it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. And so that was Was that reviewed?
One German journal reviewed it.
What did they say?
Not very much. I mean, I couldn't read it properly. It was a very short review.
What did it say in the publisher's blurb in their catalogue? Did you ever read it?
Oh, yes. I can show you it, actually. Let's look.
Yeah. All right.
Where have I got...
Okay, we have here a academic press. It's a A4 coloured sheet in full colour. At last, the human nervous system, beautifully presented in as near natural a state as can be presently hoped for. Atlas of the Cellular Structure of the Human Nervous System. Harold Hillman, David Jarman, University of Surrey, UK. Features hundreds of photographs, many in full colour, depicting the full spectrum of unfixed human nervous tissue. A truly unique achievement. Mm-hmm. On the back it's got ordering information, and another advert for a rat brain and a human nervous system thing. And here we are. Photographs included the neuroglia, the white matter, droplet fibres. This is another discovery of Harold and Dave's, I suppose I should say, and the fine structure of the nucleolus, teased tissue and hand dissected cells. Right, there we go. What about these fibres with beads on them, droplet fibres?
Hmm.
What are they? What does that? What do you conclude?
Well, we didn't conclude anything. I mean, we just described them. You know, I don't know what they do.
Okay, now, we've just had a tea break, so I'll try and take up where we left off. Okay, we've just done 1988, Vice-Chancellor. 1990, your atlas was published. 1991, the case for new paradigms in cell biology and neurobiology. Okay, it's got quite a number of chapters. It's basically a kind of mixture of evidence with your own experiences. It's a kind of rather odd book in that sense.
Yes, it is.
The title is a bit misleading, as always, with the Hillman publication.
Well, the title was originally Letter to Students of Biology of the 21st Century, and the publishers didn't like that.
Yeah, well, anyway, it's a misleading title, because there's an awful lot in it of anecdotes about visiting people and them telling you that they had to go to lunch, that sort of thing.
No, but I mean, that is, in fact, based on Dingell's book, the idea of Dingell, yeah. Which is half what the science and half the narrative, if you like.
The late Dingell, okay. Right, there's various things. There are quite a lot of tables, including one with misleading terms, which has grown considerably. Also one about unproved or unprovable hypotheses.
Yes.
Which, in fact, there are only about 15. I was quite surprised how few there were. There's also a table 9 here, possible origin of artifacts and artifacts as well.
Yes.
Things like well, they're not all that many either. Lamella of myelin's sheath, Golgi body, lysosomes, endoplasmic reticulum, Christi, cytoskeleton, synapses, synaptic thickenings, synaptic vesicles, cross bridges between muscle filaments, discs of retinal rods, thylakoid membranes, and nuclear pores.
Mm.
That's a total toll. Oh, there are some missing, aren't there? There's the microtrabeculae, for example.
Yes, but I mean, if you compare that with... I'm sure you've seen this, actually. I mean the...
1890 now, so they're very similar, right. Okay. Chapter 23 is, does the structure of the living cell matter? I said here, short and disappointing from my point of view, Harold doesn't consider how much of biology has to be thrown away, or whether electron microscopes could simply be switched to something more useful.
Well, that's not my problem, really.
Can they be switched? You didn't discuss viruses, did you? You have an opinion that viruses can be studied usefully with electron microscopes.
No, only for classification.
Only for classification, right.
The reason they can't is because round the viruses you always get what they believe to be a wall round it, but it's the same thickness whatever the size of the virus, and that's impossible.
Another artifact, yeah.
Yes.
Is that what they call the protein coat?
Yes.
Does that mean you don't believe in a protein coat?
No. You see those two? Those are the different...
Yes, I know that. Okay, now you've got here, does the structure matter? There are 7 comments. Firstly, we try and aim for scientific truth, ultimately. Secondly, a lot of these people are wasting their time. Thirdly, the ultrastructure, the attempt to correlate structure with function, they might well be wasting their time. Fourth reason, employment of the major techniques, they're wasting their time using these particular techniques, perhaps.
Yes.
Fifth point, well, obviously better findings and so on. For example, here's your example of lithium salts and penicillin as well.
Yes.
And you can't expect planned accidents to happen all the time. Sixthly, there's a thing about cynicism and so on. Seventhly, there's a thing about funding as well.
Yes.
When the argument seems to be that collectors are individually inspired by the belief that we're honest research workers.
Yes.
So we ought to be. So there are these seven rather miscellaneous reasons.
Yes,
so how was this book received? And certainly it was published by Mellon Publications, which is a very minor press indeed.
That's right.
In fact, I found a similar book about Japanese anarchists, which was a PhD thesis, published in exactly the same way, with a sort of binding with the chap's name stamped on it in silver.
Yes.
And printed from a typewritten text.
That's right. That's how they make a lot of money. They've got a huge, they've got 200 or 300 books on their list. But as a matter of fact, the head of it, a man called Professor Richardson, who's a Canadian professor, was fired from his job because he's hardly ever there, because he's running this printing.
So they make a huge amount of money out of it.
I think so. He's got a publishing house in the United States, in Canada, and in one in Wales where they publish.
Probably sure they're not just accommodation addresses or something.
No, he's actually got people working there because I've spoken.
Really, right. Can I ask how many copies your book sold? Actually, are you allowed to say that sort of thing?
Which one? The
All of them, I suppose, really. How many did the Living Cell sell?
The Living Cell sold fairly badly, I don't know.
What about the first one we know about? What about the mammalian nervous system?
That sold very badly. It was overpriced. And in fact, it's now out of print.
And what about the
Case for New Paradigms? They won't tell me how many it sold.
Okay. Well, anyway, so that was 1991. Also,
The Atlas of the Brain has gone quite well. I think it sold about 700, which is for that sort of book is quite good.
700 people, Atlas, okay. So, also, anyway, 1991, the new paradigm, the Case for New Paradigms was published. Also, your two other receptor papers You published Resistance to the Spread of Unpopular Academic Findings in 1991.
Yes.
That was for a journal called Accountability and Research.
A new journal, yes.
And I think I'm right in saying this, in 1991, both of your two final out of four receptor papers were published, the re-examination of the vesicle hypothesis.
Yes.
And a new hypothesis for electrical transmission.
Yes.
And then in 1993, I've got a gap there, 1993 you started, around about 1993, you started and you worked 3 years at the Schizophrenia Association in Bangor, three days a week.
Yes.
And you examined about 150 patients, according to my notes, which sounds like one a day on average, so.
It could have been, yes, we saw them, sometimes you saw two or three a day.
Okay, and that must have taken up quite a lot of your work.
Oh, it did, yeah.
Time. And in 1994, this is when Chan Palay, the Singaporean woman who married an American, and returned home supposedly in triumph, attacked you with great indignation.
She did, and so did this man from Charing Cross, Geary. Geary.
Mm. 1995, in Australia, Brian Freeman pointed out that cell resting potential may be an artifact of measurement.
Yes.
I think I'm right in saying that your earlier books don't mention that, so that must be a new thing.
That was a new thing and a fascinating thing, because the implications of that are extremely important.
But you said just now, talking to me, that Gilbert Ling takes that into account. He's already taken that into account.
Well, funnily enough, Gilbert Ling didn't really want to discuss this.
Well, is that because it's his own pet thing?
I would imagine so.
Hmm. You know, it scuppers some of his work, does it? I thought you told me that he managed to allow for it. Or did he invent the business of silver chloride and so on?
No, he invented the intracellular electrode, and it can be used for a lot of things. For example, it can be used for picking up excitability, but whether it can actually be used for the measurement of the voltage is a question issue which he had never discussed before.
Oh, right, I see. There's a difference between the thing wobbling, which is...
Yes,
which
it does.
Thing, and there's the static thing. Oh, right, okay. Fair enough. I've got to the end of my notes now, actually. Apart from a few things about the stakes are high.
Yes.
If I'm right, a very large proportion of experiments will have to be completed. Let's kind of stop there. And let's just do a reprise. We do that. Is it a good idea?
Yes.
I've got section five here. We can go through, basically just through your discoveries one at a time. Perhaps you can just comment on them, react to them. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
So we go back to your age. Well, it's basically between age about 32 and about 65.
Yes.
Yes,
a long time.
That's right. Powers of 2, 32 and 64. There you are. Perhaps you'll live to 128.
As a matter of fact, it's 40 years altogether. Because I started research back in 46 and I'm ending it in 96.
Right.
No, not 46, 56 and I'm ending it in 96.
Well, did you discover anything then?
What, in 56?
Yeah.
I did, actually, because I started resuscitating patients who had very low blood pressure. It would now be illegal to do, but I started...
Oh, right, and this was what grew into your sheep resuscitator thing, wasn't it?
Mm.
All right. OK, so there's resuscitation, but let's get back to... OK, 1962, published in 1964, the terminal phosphate bonds are transducer, and also 1966 paper, the effect of visible light on ATP in solution.
Yes. Yes.
What do you have to say on these?
Well, I showed that the ATP, adenosine triphosphate, phosphocreatine and phosphoarginine are sensitive to light, sound, electric current, and sodium, potassium concentration and centrifugation.
Right.
And what was interesting is that phosphocreatine and ATP, which are present in mammals, were sensitive at 37 degrees and not at 22 degrees, but phosphoarginine was sensitive at 22 degrees.
Okay.
And I did an enormous number of experiments on that, and I still think that's true.
When you say as a transducer, that doesn't mean, you know, that you can convert it from anything like light into heat.
I think that was the implication, because you see, ATP releases energy when it hydrolyzes. So if light can make it release energy and sound can, that is a proper use of the word transducer.
Okay. Well, normally a transducer, at least in the sense I use it, means that it's used for some useful property. I mean, you know, obviously, in a sense, if you have a piece of black paper out in the sun, that's transducing because it warms
that's
up.
That's right.
But it's not a transducer in the sense that you couldn't use it to make a sound with or something.
Well, what I was thinking of doing, I've got in my fun book, if ever I get around to doing, what I was thinking of doing was putting ATP in a cell and see if it generates more current, you see. And that could be a detector of light.
So anyway, so the main, what was the main effect, outcome, so on, of this work on ATP?
The main effect was I made myself very unpopular. I had greatest difficulty getting it published. In fact, that the major part of that was the only thing I didn't get published. I got the effect of light on ATP. But there are five agents and three different substances, so there are 15 different variables, and I only got one out of those 15 published.
And that was never published?
No.
I see.
But I sent it to an international exchange, which was the equivalent of publication, and it is in fact registered there, so although it wasn't formally published in a journal, it has been published.
Okay, now aged 37, you discovered the nucleolar membrane.
Yes.
Along with Sartori.
Well, strictly speaking, I didn't. I had a chap called Hussein who was doing a PhD with me, and although I actually saw it first and I showed it to him, I put him first on the paper because he was doing a PhD.
So what's the outcome of that?
The outcome of that is that there is a nucleolar membrane, which I've shown all over the world, which we illustrated in at least five publications, including our atlas, and which most people don't believe is there.
Did you find any other cells apart from neurons?
No. We found neurons and naked nuclei.
Right. Presumably, did you look anywhere else apart from neurons, I should say?
We looked for everything we could see. You know, we took the whole brain.
Did you look at any other cells apart from brain cells, nerve cells?
We looked at brain, spinal cord, and peripheral nerve. That's the whole nerve system.
Oh, you didn't look at muscles, for example?
No.
Liver cells?
No.
So they
only
could,
the
they
central
could,
nerve
so they might have nucleolar membranes in them?
They might do, but we never looked at them.
Nobody else has either, presumably.
Right.
Okay, now, a bit later on, published in 1972, business about important biochemical research techniques have never been controlled.
Yes.
Right, and that was true then. Nobody would reply to it, and it's true today.
But it's been very influential in British biochemistry.
The book has.
Yes, people are very conscious of controlled experiments nowadays.
Although
they haven't done enough of them, they're very conscious, and they very often pay lip service without actually doing all the controlled experiments.
You attribute that to your influence, do you?
I do, actually.
Were you influenced by Popper, would you say? Or was it just... Was everybody... Was it not business?
No more than anybody else.
Okay. all right now, a bit later on, 1971, published 75, most of the structures and cells apparent by electron microscopy are artifacts.
Plus the Golgi apparatus, which was described in 1898.
Oh, yes, okay. And that was because of silver staining,
yes,
presumably.
Yes. Yes, this view has not been accepted by anybody else in public, although quite a few people tell me they haven't had it.
Has it influenced theory at all? I mean, do people place less... for example, there's a theory that proteins were made in ribosomes or something, which of course...
Yes, that's right. It hasn't affected theory or practice or really? Belief at all.
So that's... hundreds of papers still
involved. Yes, people still say that. In fact, as teaching a student, I teach, I do a bit of cramming. And I had to tell this poor young lady that, the proteins are synthesized in the ribosome.
So you were 45 when you said that. It must have been quite a major thing, I suppose.
Mm.
Oh, not 45, I mean, 45 when it's published. Okay. Mm. Now, big leap, now in your 50s, mid-50s, when you looked at into anatomical synapses as distinguished from synapses, and you went through Sherrington and so on, you discovered that they don't exist, and the transmission hypothesis therefore can hardly
exist.
Well,
I first of all found out or showed by evidence from the literature that synapses don't exist. Now, synapse is a nerve-nerve connection.
Mm.
It is to be distinguished from a neuromuscular junction,
right,
which I do believe exists.
Are there not also nerve-nerve junctions in the sense that a very long nerve, which, a single nerve...
But they're still synapses, where they connect their synapses.
They're called synapses?
Yes. In other words, if one nerve going next to another has no influence on it, as far as is known.
Yeah, what I mean is, if you've got a very long nerve...
Yes.
That's not just one cell, as a rule, is it? It can be a lot of several...
No, what happens with a long one, they have synapses at intervals. In other words, you have a long one.
See,
there.
I've got this problem of understanding, of trying to work out whether you all... got your tongue in which you've got. Do you mean they've got synapses? They have a join? Or do you mean
they have a join, which other people call synapses.
Do they have a join at all then?
No, they don't.
They're
next to each other.
One of them stops.
Well, it's partly a semantic problem. Supposing you take two wires and you join them around to each other.
Yeah.
Are they joined together or are they not?
Well, I don't know. You tell me.
Well, they're both are or aren't.
Well,
I mean, in other words, if you take that plug there, there's just one wire twisted round another. Obviously, they are in continuity from an electrical point of view.
But you're saying it's like a neuromuscular junction. There is definitely a junction.
Well, the nerve comes up to here and the muscle is there.
There are two. Yes, but when you've got one long nerve and you're saying it's...
When you have one long nerve, it's synapses. What they mean by that is that, supposing you have a nerve from nerve cell in the brain, it has a long axon which goes down here into the spinal cord.
Just one.
Yes, and in the spinal cord...
Are you saying that long nerves are always just one long process?
No, very often they synapse on the way.
That means there's another nucleus further down with its own processes.
Another cell, that's right. That's
and
right.
That definitely exists in your view.
No
ambiguity about that.
No
ambiguity. And they look different under the electron microscope, presumably, assuming you could find where the join was. Does anybody know where the join... It must be quite difficult to find one, presumably.
Well, it's very difficult to find them in the central nervous system. That's part of my case.
Right.
But what they do is, you see, I did mention this before, but Sherrington said there must be a connection because
when
we stimulate there, we get a reaction there. And then the light microscopy said, well, we can see some end feet, so that's where it must be.
Yes, he was using a sort of telephone wire model.
Yes, yes.
But you're saying, okay, I was just querying this particular point. I accept there are neuromuscular junctions, although I don't know what the junctions are. And I accept also that they do, that if you've got a very long nerve, it can be split into several nerves,
yes,
which unquestionably connect up in some
like
way.
Relay, yes.
Okay.
But
and that's what you agree with that?
Yes,
you're not just tongue-in-cheek or something.
But when, whereas everybody else in the world believes that nerve A liberates a transmitter which goes to nerve B, which stimulates it,
right.
I believe that nerve A has an electric field around it,
right,
and that electric field is conducted in the fine granular material in the brain to the next nerve.
And in do long nerves have fine granular material too?
No, long nerves conduct directly, they're like wires.
Do they have...
That's called conduction in...
Yeah, what about between where they join up to another?
When you say they join up, they don't join up, they're near each other.
All right, well, what happens there, for Christ's sake?
I just told you, electric current...
Then you change the brain, okay. What in a long nerve, it's conducted across the gap, is it, without using
That's right. It's like, it's like a broadcast.
Okay. All right. So there's that's so much of the synapses.
Yeah.
And you came across that as a result of considering silver-stained microarchs and just looking at them and saying these
are peculiar. Well, I give about six reasons why there are.
Yeah, but I mean that was where it fundamentally started. Yes. You did research. Yeah. You searched the not so much the literature, the
slides and
the iconography.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, and as a result of that, you concluded that the transmission hypothesis must be peculiar and doubtful.
Must be wrong because the synapse is a central part of it.
Right. So at the same time, the sliding filament hypothesis, you examined this widely reproduced picture of the sliding filament thing under electron microscopy.
Yes.
And along with other people, decided that must be wrong, and that's due for publication soon.
Well, it's not due for publication. I've started looking at it recently. I haven't actually finished all the publications.
Okay, there's a lot of.
But I'm doing it now.
Okay, and a lot of diagrams and things, no doubt.
Yeah.
Okay, anyway, then. Okay, then.
I'm doing that with Brian Freeman in Australia.
Now, this is all tied up with the effects of staining. As I presume, I don't know when you started this, to what extent it became formalised, so to speak, but in 1987 your film was produced about the effects of staining, and of course that was included in the mammalian nervous system.
Yes.
So what do you have to say about that?
Well, we studied the three of the best known methods of staining, and they all showed considerable shrinkage and distortion. So we have said to other people, now you must look, whenever you use staining, at what it does to the shape and size of the things you're staining. But you see, histology is used for two totally different purposes. One of them is to find out illness. In other words, you've got an ill person,
right,
and you've got a lesion, and you know empirically that illness is associated with that lesion.
When you say what do you mean by lesion?
A lesion is an ill piece of tissue.
Okay, so it's exactly analogous to the use of electron microscopes for viruses. You end up with something
empirically has been related.
Yeah, right.
But
otherwise, you see something there, which every time somebody with a disease presents
precisely.
Well, you hope it
but if you want to ask the question, what does a cell look like in life,
right,
you cannot use any dehydrating technique because they are mostly water.
Could you just briefly, okay, you did a series of controlled experiments with slices of the brain and you showed they didn't overlap. In other words, you end up with 80% of the brain unstained.
Yes.
What's the significance of that?
Well, most people believe, and this was said in a in a special issue of Scientific American in 1979 on the brain. Most people believe that the brain is composed of these four elements. So if you stained them one by one, the whole area will be stained.
Right. But if, in your view, staining is okay, so one of your arguments is that if the thing ends up, 80% empty, then their model can't be correct.
And we actually showed that because we stained with the different kinds of staining.
But nevertheless, if you're right and that staining is not that staining is not specific, then that model brain could be correct.
No, it's just that it makes it worse. Because if it's not specific...
Yeah. The question I made there was that if staining is not specific, then presumably you could still have the traditional model of the brain. And some of the... if the stain... I'm assuming the stains are not 100%, don't stain them 100%, therefore it would still be possible for the traditional model of the brain to be true, even if the stains are not specific.
No, because if they're not specific, then a smaller percentage, when you add them all up together, a smaller percentage than we got would be stained.
Okay, when you say specific...
Well, you see, they believe they're specific for the four different kinds of cells.
They believe that every single cell of the type ends up dyed, or just a proportion of them.
Yes.
That's what specific means. It means that all of them will be dyed.
It means that each different kind of cell is stained by a particular...
Yeah, but 100% of them are.
If they were right, then they actually say this, that the expression he uses, the whole brain will be black. Black means stained, in other words. The whole brain would be black if we were to stain them up.
Okay, so your staining experiments have several functions. One of them is to highlight distortions and so on. One of them is
there were different experiments.
Yeah, and one of them is brain specific. It's to
yes.
do with
no, the ones on staining, we did a very interesting thing, a very simple thing. We take a single nerve cell and put it under the microscope.
Yeah.
Photograph it. Then we add each of the reagents. That's what our film is. I think you saw the film, didn't
yes.
you? And as you add it, you see that particular cell staining.
Right. Yes. And then you yes, and you keep the
Same cell.
And you draw the size of it before and after. Yes, that's right. Okay, and these experiments have not been done before, mm-hmm. what you're saying, at least yeah. not as a, maybe in parts, perhaps.
Nobody's done these specific experiments
at
all.
Isn't it rather remarkable that nobody has done
yes,
it?
Yes, very remarkable. Or since. Don't forget, my book came out in 1986.
Presumably, part of the reason for this is that, you know, the high status it's got by inventing a stain of your own, with its own wonderful properties, rather than...
Well,
doing detailed work. That's why they've got names yeah. for them, isn't it?
No, I think it wasn't quite that. I think that the people who actually designed them believed them to be to show up particular kinds of cells, but they did not claim them to be specific.
Mm.
They didn't claim them to show other cells. This is what I showed in my book, that what they think of as a stain for astrocytes, when it was originally described, they said it stained astrocytes, but it sometimes stained neurons. And the stains for neurons say they stain neurons and sometimes stain astrocytes. But since then, people who haven't read the original papers actually have believed that they alleged
yes.
they were specific.
What I'm saying is I'm distinguishing between people who do that type of experiment and people who might do controlled experiments. Presumably there's more status in having a stain named after you.
Yes, but in those days nobody did controlled experiments. If Ramon y Cajal said that this stained astrocytes, everybody said it. They didn't ask him, well, does it stain neurons or microglia?
Well,
because he was too great a man, he said so. So it's in all the books.
Oh, you think it's just a authoritarian thing?
Yes, yes, it is.
What would have happened if anybody had said, maybe it doesn't, and tested it? Or is it impossible to know what would have happened?
Well, it is impossible, except that in my book, which you may have seen, you probably couldn't read them because they're too small print. But there was a 3 or 5 page summary of all the publications showing that one person would say that something is specific for astrocytes, another person would use the same stain to say it was specific for oligodendrocytes.
Yeah, I'm not sure the point you're making there.
Well, the point I'm making
is complete confusion.
But I mean, what one authority thinks is specific for one kind of cell, another authority thinks it doesn't.
So his word would go in his lab, presumably.
That's right, exactly.
So you're saying that things now are similar to that, only
yes,
not so bad at all?
Absolutely similar.
Okay, now let's look at this other thing. 1995, Brian Freeman points out to you that the resting potential maybe or probably is an artifact of measurement.
Well, no, there is a resting potential. One can't tell what it is.
It may be an artifact of measurement.
No, it's not a total artifact. The value might not be correct. It's not a total artifact.
Isn't it? How do you know? I'm just saying it might be an artifact of measurement. There might not be one at all, presumably.
There might not be one. I think there's likely to be one.
Well, just because there are ions on one side and the
yes,
other,
that's
and there's
right.
just a difference between them.
That's right, exactly.
Okay. What concludes? So what? What does that?
Well, this has important, because what he pointed out was, you see, what you do is you compare, you put an iron-containing electrode on the outside of the cell, and when you go into the cell, it changes its voltage.
Yeah.
And anybody would think, well, that shows there's a voltage when you cross the cell membrane.
Yeah.
But the electrode behaves quite differently in the two different solutions.
What I mean, I'm really talking about the theory, so what difference does it make if there's no resting potential, or if the resting potential is different?
Well, it means that you can't measure any voltage across the cell membrane.
Well, what are the effects?
Well, the whole of physiology and biophysics is based on measurement of transmembrane potentials.
So what effects does it have if the potentials are deemed different to what they were thought to be before?
Well, it means that the theory upon which Hodgkin and Huxley got the Nobel Prize, the ionic basis of electroactivity in the brain, collapses.
Right. What other? Why is that? And what other? Can you generalise why it's important rather than just picking out one example?
Well, it's because the whole of biophysics of the nervous system
yeah,
is
so
based
so
on these measurements.
So what effects does that have on anything?
Well, firstly, it means all the teaching is wrong, but it means all the values are wrong and all the calculations are wrong.
Yeah. So what effects does that have?
Well, it means that. I would think that 30 or 40% of all biophysics is wrong.
So what are the effects of that?
Well, the minimum you can say is that people are wasting their time.
What uses are made of biophysical results at the moment, if any?
Oh, calculation of the theory of muscle contraction, of nerve conduction, of transmission, of viscosity, elasticity.
Okay, you're saying biophysics is used normally as a kind of backup, a bit like maths in civil engineering
that's
or something.
Right, that's right,
it's
exactly.
A kind of collection of techniques which
that's
we
right, yes.
Try and apply. So
yes, the application of physics to biological
right.
systems.
So what conclusions, if these figures are wrong, what sort of effects does that have? Does
it devastating.
Yes, like what? On what?
Well, as I say, the theory, everybody in the world believes they know how conduction occurs,
yeah.
How transmission occurs, how muscle contracts.
Right. So, okay, now your claim is not just that the things could be wrong. What are you claiming, let me think? But it's actually impossible to get it right. You're not just saying that...
Yes, it may be uncertain.
All right. Now, there's only one other thing I've got here that which I've classified as a rediscovery, possibly unfairly, in published in 1986, that there are only nerve cells and naked nuclei in a ground substance in the brain and spinal cord. What do you have to say about that?
Well, when Virchow said that there were only nerve cells and naked nuclei, he believed it and everybody believed it. Since then, people believe they had advanced it by identifying the other three kinds of cells.
Right.
Now, I wouldn't call it a discovery, because we've shown that the other three kinds of cells don't exist there.
It's a quasi-discovery, exactly analogous to electron microscopy.
Yes.
Right. So you're back in
1845. No, 1849.
I see. Okay, the other four things, the four discoveries, are dated between 85 and 91, and these are your four receptor papers, starting with the synapse, then receptors, particular
yes.
receptors, then looking again at the vesicle hypothesis of transmission.
Yes.
And then the new hypothesis for
yes.
electrical transmission.
Yes, what you've left out there is our work on resuscitation.
Was that relevant to... Oh, I see what you... I'm sorry, yes, okay. We mentioned that right at the beginning.
Yeah.
You said resuscitation.
Yes. Yes, well, what we did, I mean, we devised a new method of resuscitation.
Okay, right. What about these receptors papers? Are they now a complete series? Is that all
yes.
you have to say on them?
Yes.
That's your complete works on receptors?
Yes.
Right. And what's the reception been of them? What have you been through this?
Well, two of them, no. Yes, they were either published in Horobin's journal, which is a medical hypothesis, which is a
yes.
very good journal, but it's a theoretical journal, and a lot of people think badly of it precisely because it publishes papers like mine.
It's a fringe one.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, Ling runs another journal called Physics, Biology and Nuclear Magnetic Resonance. It's a very good journal, which he runs himself, and he puts his own papers in it. He put my paper in it, and he does something better than that, because after each paper, he allows people who disagree to comment.
Right.
And in my paper, he was so upset by it that he got three different people to comment on.
This was the paper about resting potentials.
No, we haven't published that. No, this is a paper about various artifacts in which I wrote a lot. Various artifacts in cells, but he did publish it nevertheless. But people say there you are. You see, they're only in these sort of peripheral journals.
Yes.
They haven't been published in Nature.
Well, that's perfectly true, isn't it?
But I'm sure I gave you recently a paper which was published in Experientia.
Yes, you did.
Which pointed out there were no controls.
The book, Birkhauser or something.
Yes, Birkhauser.
Yes, well, it wasn't really papers, it was only one page.
It was a page, that's right, just one page. But what I'm saying is that I tried to get that into Nature, I tried to get it into Science, to force somebody to answer it.
And they wouldn't publish it?
No.
I'm not surprised, I mean, I'm not tempted personally into the delusion that thinking that things like Science are good magazines. I think they're sort of rubbish. I mean, they'll publish stuff which is...
Well, they're in the pockets. They're in the pockets of the establishment. Or they are the establishment.
Yeah, but not just in the science sense, but in the overall social sense. You know,
yeah, well, I think they try very hard. But as I say, people, if... You know, if you believe something, it's very difficult to approve the publication of something which shows that you've wasted the whole of your life.
Yes. But, yes. So what do you... Okay, I've got to the end of my list of things. I mean, okay, so we've basically... I started kind of trying to do the scene setting.
Yes.
I went through kind of year by year up to your present age.
Yes.
65.
Well, I will summarise by saying that I have taken issue with so many different people that I can't possibly win. At the same time, I cannot get a proper audience for my publications, precisely because the respectable journals won't publish them. And although I've got them all published except some of the effects of the physical agents on the other high-energy phosphates other than ATP. All the others have been published. They've been published in journals which are not prestigious.
Are they obtainable? And if somebody wanted to look your stuff up?
Oh, yes, they're all obtainable.
Maybe in theory, but I mean, you say in any library, if somebody in Colorado wanted to get your books, would he be able to?
Oh, yes.
Well, how?
Oh. Well, they've got the National Library Service.
I mean, he'd have to order them through some central system.
Well, I mean, there's a National Library Service here. You can get any...
Yes, I know. Well, in principle, it's just a nuisance, that's all.
It takes a little bit of time. But I mean, if they write to me, I very strictly answer every single letter I get. I replied a huge letter, which I got 3 pages long, and I replied with a 5-page long letter by a fellow who'd been teaching all his life, and he asked me some of these questions at the Quecket meeting last week. And I replied in detail, and I always do that, I reply in detail.
What about journals? I mean, presumably they must be even harder to get hold of than books.
No. You can get them from any science library now.
But not the obscure ones. I don't want to stop
You can.
You think so?
Yes. I mean, if you want the Quecket Journal, you can get they can get you a copy of it. If you want any journal, they always get you. I mean, ordinary libraries will do it as well as science.
You've made some attempt to study the lives of kind of famous heretic types, for want of a better word, like Semmelweis.
Mm.
Have you managed to draw any conclusions, for example, about the timing? You know, it might be that once the old guard die off, maybe there's always a time lapse of 20 years or 50 years.
No, I've simply taken on too many enemies.
Yeah, I'm asking a different question. I'm asking, in your studies of, so far as they exist, of these people, have you come to any conclusions? Maybe they're too diverse to be.
They are too diverse, but don't forget, most of them suffered very badly. I mean, Semmelweis was a typical example. He died in a lunatic asylum.
But is he a typical example? I mean.
Well, I mean, Virchow, he went out of pathology into public health.
You mean Virchow was not approved of?
No, he wasn't.
Oh, I didn't know that.
He went into public health. Of course, Ehrlich and Koch, they did very well for themselves. They were rather unusual in that sense.
Are you saying they were great dissidents in their time?
No, they weren't dissidents.
Well, why is it unusual that they should do well for themselves?
Well, because the whole of the scientific and medical system has tremendous resistance.
So they were dissidents?
Well, in the sense that anybody who thinks of anything is a dissident, because they're a minority of one at the beginning.
Hmm. Okay, so I get the impression you've kind of dipped into these things. You haven't kind of got a general theory of dissidents.
No, I don't think there is a general theory. I think each one is different. I mean, Pasteur achieved great fortune and fame. I think mostly he deserved it. Whereas, people like Mendel, I mean, he died unknown virtually. You know Gregor Mendel?
Yes. Yes, his work had to be rediscovered.
Yes. But I'm not interested in fame. I'm absolutely certain I'm right, and the reason I'm certain I'm right is because people get angry when I discuss an ordinary scientific problem with them.
Hmm.
And I don't know how much you've done of it, but any time you meet a biologist, he gets very angry with you if you told him the endoplasmic reticulum was an artifact.
Yes, I've had a bit of experience with just trying people in labs, and meeting people around. For example, the one in the scanning lab at Guildford, I told this woman it might change her intellectual life, chatting to you, because you were about to leave. And she didn't turn up, of course.
No.
Similarly, I met a woman, I think she was a teacher at an internet cafe in London. I told her something similar. She just, because she worked for Professor so-and-so, whatever. And she just kind of said, oh, well, goodbye.
Well, you know that book, this atlas we had?
Yes.
There's a chap I know at the Institute of Neurology. He's a member of the Quecket. He's a technician there, you see. And he put up that leaflet I showed you on the notice board.
Yes.
At the Institute of Neurology, where there's a large pathology department, which this is highly relevant to. And the head of the department took it down and he said, oh, everything they say is rubbish. He didn't even want the book to be ordered by the library there. They told me in the library.
Where's the Institute of Neurology?
That's the National Hospital for Nervous Diseases, Queen Square. It's the prime neurological hospital in the country.
I see. Yes, okay. Fair enough. What do you think of the comments I made right at the... I suppose you obviously don't agree with them. The comments I made at the beginning of just presentation and...
Well, we've had a continuous disagreement about this presentation question.
Yeah, well, my point of view is different from yours, isn't it?
Yes, that's right.
I think from my point of view, it seems there is some mileage in the argument that you don't seem to learn from experience.
We've discussed this.
It's hopeless trying to address.
No, we've discussed this thing before. I believe that if you say anything clearly, which people don't like, they get very angry about it, they won't consider the evidence, and however diplomatically you put it, if you put it sufficiently diplomatic that it's not obvious, then they will agree with some generalisation. They'll agree, oh yes, there are artifacts in electronics. Oh, I agree that there's some shrinkage. Oh, he's got some idea, some good points. But if you actually...
You're saying that might open the door?
No, I don't think it'll open the door.
Oh.
Because I think that...
So you're saying it might just as well be completely clear?
That's right. Because if you say it loudly and clearly, they get angry. And if you say it sufficiently mutedly, they can ignore it.
Right, so you're saying you should be loud and clear?
Yes, I think so. Right. I've had arguments with my collaborators.
Well, I personally agree. I just don't think... I suppose we disagree on what is loud and clear.
Mm. Well, actually, I would love to set up another debate. I mean, there hasn't been a debate since 1980. I wonder if the... Do you go to London Skeptics?
I went once. I could get in touch, I suppose. I'm not in touch particularly.
Yes. At University College...
Do you think debates are worth going to? And if you've had several hundred in your life, it seems like...
No, I've only had two debates in the whole run-up.
Right, lectures, you mean?
Yes. Lectures are the same as a debate.
Okay, by debate you mean you have to get some opponent.
Yes. Mm. And they all run away. On several occasions, the BBC has wanted to set up programmes, television people, and they've been... the particular example I think I give in my book is University College, where they told them that nobody believes in the endoplasmic reticulum, so that I was tilting against windmills. Can you imagine that?
Right. This was a Horizon or something like that.
Yes, one of these
science programs. Yes. Supposedly science program.
Yes. It was the other one. What's it called? Not Horizon, but there's one like it called...
I don't know. Wouldn't be Tomorrow's World, would it?
No, not Tomorrow's World. No. It was like Horizon. Anyhow. Not Panorama. Anyhow. But several occasions they've told the BBC that.
Okay. What about the very great problem that people are overawed by the huge mass of material. There are all these hundreds of papers, hundreds of journals, all saying exactly the opposite to you.
Well, exactly. That is one of the reasons why you said to me earlier, well, what about the 30% or 40% of research rate, which is good?
In your opinion, it might be.
In my good, yes. Well, might be. But even if it were all good, it's a very large noise-to-signal ratio.
Hmm.
In other words, there's so much noise from this crap they talk. I mean, Greenfield talks total crap, and I would never say it to her face. But if you could manage to get a debate with her, and me, I would frankly wipe the floor with her.
Really, it'd be interesting to.
But she wouldn't do it. because she's now part of the establishment, you see. She is a lecturer, I think, at Oxford. Is Oxford, Cambridge, Oxford?
She's at Lincoln College.
Oxford.
I remember that from the letter you wrote. I think that's Oxford. Yes, I'm not sure.
But, you know, she's at the establishment, you see. She writes articles in the Times and the Sunday Times, and she...
Yes, you tell me what's that, you know, she's... OK, last year, early this year, she gave a talk on consciousness.
Yes.
And you said that was absolute crap. It's, you know, consciousness...
It has no physiological substrate.
Well, that doesn't mean it's crap, does it, though?
No, but she's a physiologist.
Yeah, you mean she's not entitled to say anything about it?
Yes, exactly.
Anything more than...
I mean, it's like asking me to talk about transubstantiation. You know, I'm not an expert on it. And I certainly wouldn't appear on the BBC on it.
What about the problem, as I said just now, which you don't seem to have answered, that if you're a student or whatever, or a reader or anything, there's this huge mass of impressive-looking stuff with long words, you know, which appears to mean something.
Yes, well, what you regard a person like me as a bloody nuisance, because you ask awkward questions, which might be true or might not be true, but you've got to teach students, you've got to pass examinations, you've got to get grants.
That's right. Well, it's not just that, it's also researchers as well.
Yes.
But well, I mean, that's a serious problem, there's an amount of stuff, and it does look impressive.
Well, it's also the other point which I made to you several times, that if you spend 3 years doing a PhD...
You're not readdressing the question. Yes, I take your points about vested interest and so on, but you're in the... If you look at an establishment like the medical establishment, suppose you were, you know, 50 years ago something, and you were combating the medical establishment about anything, you know, fibre in food or something, you've got these huge volumes, they all say that you're talking rubbish, right? And they're all wrong, but...
Yeah.
The problem is attacking it and sort of self-confidence and so on. Do you have anything to say about that?
I mean, well, it's... unfortunately, it gets back to what I said before, that you can have one enemy, but if you've got, you know, 25 enemies, you can't win. However right or wrong you are.
That's not quite... If you look at things like contraception, for example, you know, Mary Stopes had immense opposition.
Yes, but on one issue...
Oh, I see what you're talking about, issues rather than people.
Yes, one issue. I'm quite sure that if I spent the rest of my life, I could show to everybody's satisfaction the endoplasm, which was an artifact, people would laugh when you mentioned it.
From then on, you mean?
Yes.
Like phrenology or something?
Yes, or like, what's the name of that Frenchman who had special kind of...
Oh, Enraes, yes, the chap from Nancy.
Yes, Blondoy.
Blondelot, I think, was his name.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you're still not addressing the question that you've got this very impressive stuff, and somehow you've got to try and couple it, make it look ridiculous.
Yes, but I mean, I can only... Let me tell you how you can do it. You do it at international conferences where they won't let me speak. You do it at lectures where they generally don't invite me. Although I've given a lot.
No, you're not. Even if your lectures are successful, you'd still have this volume of material, and it would be impressive looking, and lots of students and so on would be faced by it, and
that's
people
right.
doing research.
But isn't it exactly analogous with the religious situation?
It's very closely similar, because there's a money involved.
In fact, there's a theology,
the theology has nothing to do with it. It's a money involvement. That's
well,
the
I wouldn't
point.
Just put it in the money, it's the power and the social organisation,
the
prestige.
That's right. So the theology, the kind of theory, has nothing to do with it, in my opinion.
Little to do with it. Little.
Except in the sense, of course, it has to be disguised. You have fancy, you know, you have elaborate words and phrases.
That's right, exactly.
If you look at, for example, the way Hegel was developed at the end of the 19th century, you get very florid sort of stuff.
That's right, absolutely.
And that looks impressive. But, the question is, well, in the case of Hegel in Britain, I don't know what happened in Germany, in Britain, Moore just attacked it, and everybody, well, Russell climbed down, and there was a general, it just kind of...
Disappeared.
But I mean, presumably that was partly... I mean, there just weren't that many academics around then.
Yes.
And the new ones came along, you know,
but
groups.
But again, it's still a relatively one-issue situation.
Yeah, that's true. Well, it's sort of true, except that Hegelianism did claim to cover space, time, history, and all of human life.
Oh, yes, that's true. That's true. But, I mean, it's still one concept, really.
Yeah. I mean, I still don't know that I'm getting my point through, really, that you've got these papers, huge amounts.
No, you're asking me how I could advance my belief.
No, you're taking an egocentric point of view. What I'm saying is, looking at it from the students, from everyone else's point of view, they look around, they're in a laboratory, there are huge volumes of, bound volumes of papers, they've opened anyone, and books, numbers of books on learned discussions, you know, meetings on these synapses, you know, expensive conferences that people go to, hundreds of them every day of the week, huge, great, massive things, full of, you know, typewritten, photocopied, luxuriously printed things, all of these diagrams. In. I'm not talking about you, I'm talking about them. From their point of view, how can they... They've got. To, they have to have some way through it. Sort of
The bottom line is intellectual honesty, isn't it?
That's. But I don't know. I mean, they have to. It has to be presented. They have to have some way. No, but
look. This lady you met in the library. Supposing she came to my lab and sat down, and I told her that all these things were artifacts. What would she do? She'd get very embarrassed. She wouldn't know what to do. Because she's probably doing a PhD, and she's not going to give up her PhD on the endoplasmic.
So it's her limitations, really, you're saying that?
Yes.
You're not giving her... Well, the part of the problem is, though, that she doesn't have a complete... Well, maybe I don't know if it's complete, I don't know.
No, but I mean, even if she did, supposing I go to her supervisor and I tell him, he'd get very angry for
me. No, but sort of ego-centred again. You'll think about you doing things.
No. I'm not talking being ego-centred. I'm telling you the general proposition.
Right, suppose...
Let me give you an analogy. I've got a book over there which has got, from two of the Gospels, the lineage of Jesus from the house of David. You know, and they're both different.
Mm.
Now, you take that to a religious Christian and say to him, now, look, this is impossible because you believe both books and they're both different. What will he do? He'll get very embarrassed and throw you out, or want to throw you out.
Yeah, but we're talking about a different thing.
Really. No, you're not.
Imagine you're a student and you need to be, there are all these things which you're presented with implicitly in all these impressive looking publications, and they've got one of or two of your books. What are they to make of it? How are they to respond? How are they to deconstruct?
Well, I'll tell you, I had a very intelligent Danish man working with me. And he largely agreed with what I said. And he asked me, he was doing a PhD with me, he asked me what he should do in life, you see. And I said, the best thing is for you to take up an area which, on mature consideration, especially if you agree with me, you've read my works, is not covered by this, preferably an empirical area.
Yeah.
You know, that's the only thing to do.
What did he do?
Well, he did, in fact, do that. He's a psychiatrist, actually.
Oh, I see.
So what he did a study of a large number of patients of different kinds. That's fine, empirical, you see. And you can look for the biochemical changes in that particular condition. You know, again, empirically, if there are any.
Yes.
And that's what I advise. Now, I had another chap who was doing a PhD with me, the one who we pretend found the nucleolar membrane. He was as dumb as anything. And I think I told you, he took out of my first book a large section attacking the electron microscope. And he was writing a thesis on isolated nerve cells, there's nothing to do with it. So I said, why did you put this in? He said, he thought it would please me. I said, but your thesis has nothing to do with electron microscopy. You haven't touched an electron microscope. So he took it out after, you know, after I persuaded him to. And about a few weeks later, he came back to me and he said to me, could I get him a job? Did I know anybody who had a job in biology? I said, what? Did he want to go into it? He said, electron microscopy.
That's strange.
And he's now a professor, largely in electron microscopy.
Where?
In one of the Gulf states. But what I mean is that man, frankly, was so dim, it didn't really matter what he did in life. But the Danish chap was very, very intelligent, and I would have been very sorry had he gone into something which, you know, had he gone into subcellular fractionation.
Yes, I tell you, but I'm still somewhat, I still don't know what to say about this. Let me give you an analogy. If you, suppose you're interested in history, and you, suppose you find out that in the 18th century there were continual, you know, there was slave trading going on and this huge industry of slave trading. And the traditional model of the 18th century is that, you know, there are all these gentlemanly people sitting around in salons and so on. And there's huge numbers of books on it, you know, and history magazines and journals, and they all say the same sort of thing. It's just, what do you do? What does the...
It's not.
And somebody, you know, you come across this in some way, analogous to reading one of your books.
Yes.
What... what are they supposed to do? I don't know.
No, I agree, it's a personal problem. But what you do, I think, is I can't answer for anybody in that situation because I feel very sorry for them.
It's not just, you're quite missing the point, really. They might think they're wrong. They might start to think, well, I must be wrong about this, or, you know.
Well, that's what everybody thinks. They say, look, Hillman can't be the only soldier marching in time. That's what I think, quite properly.
So you don't.
They think there must be an answer to this endoplasmic reticulum problem.
So there's no solution to this general problem. You just have to try and read and think and all the rest of it.
Yes. And, I mean, a lot of people, including Ling, said to me, well, your enemies will die out. I don't think it's a famous Chinese saying or something, isn't it?
I doubt it. I mean, there's a whole industry of inventing imitation and sayings.
That's right. But I mean, they say that, you know, you never conquer with a new idea. What you do is you wait till your enemies die out. Mm. Well, I don't think that's so, because the more bad research goes on, the more people have a vested interest in the bad research. So I will never win, and I won't even win in several hundred years.
You think so? You think this will be going on in the 2300 or something?
I'm sure it will.
You think so?
Yes, I mean, for the same reason as all major religions are still going strong, are they?
Well, I wouldn't say they're going strong exactly. I think they have serious problems.
They have problems, but they're still very influential.
Are they?
Oh, yes.
I wouldn't go so far as to say that. They do get, of course, you know, state aid and so on. So analogies with.
That's true. But I mean, the Catholic Church, the Islam, you know, they're.
What do you think of Theocharis's idea? I mean, he favours privatisation, doesn't he? He thinks that research the government should offer. Do you remember what he said? I mean, his exact example was Harrison's chronometer. He said the government, they didn't offer money to Oxford and Cambridge to solve this problem of finding longitude. Yeah. I think it was.
Yeah.
Was it latitude? Longitude. He said, we'll offer a prize after the event. You know?
Yeah, to anybody, yes.
Yeah, and
well, of course, you have to be a man of leisure to be able to do that.
Well, it would be a sort of investment thing, wouldn't it? Do you have any views on that particular idea?
No, I don't like it, because it means it's like a competition for architects, you know. A whole lot of people put in a lot of work, and one person gets it.
That's right. So if you reject the Theocharis solution, what are you left with?
Well, you're left with going on clapping and feeling very sorry for the people who are wasting their time.
I confess I find that feeling highly misplaced.
Hi.
Hi.
This situation now.
It's
a believer's situation. Isn't it?
Yes. I mean, I don't. My model of religion is different from yours. You think that people actually believe what they say. And I think in religion, most people who are supposed believers, you know, the belief is negligible.
But I think you'd agree that's the thing you can't establish. It's not a general answer.
Oh, no, you can, because you can ask people.
Yes, but you see such a small sample. You see a non-statistical sample.
Well, I could easily do a statistical sample. You can easily ask. I've noticed it in any religion. If you ask C of E people what their views are, and you look up any aspect of the church, or the religion, or history of it, they don't know the first thing about it. Same with my mother-in-law, ex-mother-in-law, is an enthusiastic Jew. And I asked her about things like the Aramaic-speaking Jews, and she doesn't know the first thing about it. And this is absolutely standard. The reason that they are so-called religious is because it's a kind of social thing.
I know, but isn't that exactly analogous with science? I mean, you know, there's a whole religion.
You're assuming that the belief system is relevant. But
No. The religion, we've discussed this before, religion consists of about five different elements, but science does as well. There's what we can call the theology, the ethics, the organisation, the money, people.
If by theology you mean mouthing a set of a creed.
Well, that's exactly the same thing.
Same thing as it,
isn't it?
It's closely similar. It can't be quite the same, because they do what looks like research.
It's not quite the same, but it's very closely.
Well, you don't get theologians doing what they call research, do they? Although they do write.
No, they do. They do.
They write Sunday. Yeah. They write their parish magazines, don't they?
Well, no, they do research. I mean, you can do research on the ancient Israelites, and you look up all the references in the Bible, then you look up any references you can find in Egyptian literature, you know, or the tombs or the writing they have, what do you call the you know.
Hieroglyphics, don't you?
Hieroglyphics, yes. Right. I mean, that's perfectly good research. It's, if you like, empirical research.
I suppose that is analogous to looking at back numbers of papers, isn't it?
Yes.
Although I can't think of any practical equivalent, although I suppose there are some. They don't have labs, do they?
Well, I mean, if you take a person like Karl Marx or Hegel, for that matter, I mean, they had a tremendous knowledge of history, and they made up theories of economics on the basis of their knowledge of history.
Bertie Russell said that Karl Marx, displayed great ignorance of history. But, I suppose it depends on that, what you regard as being a lot of historical knowledge.
Yes, yes.
Oh dear, right. Well, you've got a few minutes left on this tape. Do you want to use them up?
I don't think so. I mean,
you've discovered. Have you noticed? Okay, in your discoveries, we've been through them. Mm-hmm. There was you started with ATP,
mm-hmm.
and then there's the general idea of controlled experiments not being done, and then electron microscopy. Well, that's part of the same thing, artifacts. And then a whole lot of hypotheses to do with the brain.
Yes.
Is there any possibility you might discover a whole lot of other things? For example, to do with the way the body works or something like that. Can you see,
well,
in 10 years' time you might see something?
I'm developing a theory on cancer based on my findings in the brain.
Right.
That's
more... Okay, I remember you saying that cancer in the brain is able to propagate quickly because it's a syncytium.
That's
nothing
correct.
To stop it.
Yes, yes. That's my theory. I mean, that's the basic...
Oh, right. Laptop being cell membranes presumably being tough enough to... have some effect normally.
Yes, that's right. Well, to resist, I mean, if you get off a crowded train, there's a crowd standing there, it's not easy to walk through.
Does that only apply to brain tumours, though?
No, that's why I'm developing a more general theory. Because I don't think... there are lots of tissues which are syncytia, including muscle.
Oh, really? I didn't know
that. Most people don't consider them syncytia nowadays, but they used to.
The only other example I heard of was fungi, some sort of...
Oh, fungi. Some fungi are syncytia.
Right. So basically you're going to look around at lots of syncytia.
Well, I've got a list somewhere of them, for example.
Right. And so you look at muscle sarcoma, that kind of thing.
Yes, precisely.
Right. So you might get somewhere with cancer. But then, of course, presumably you'd have the problem of publishing it and so on.
Oh, yes, yes.
Do you think you might find some tie-up there with supposedly crank views on... I mean, my brother's got this thing about the Hoxie Clinic, which was notorious in America for being... persecuted, but nevertheless it seemed to work in some cases.
Yes. Well, I haven't heard of it, but I mean, one is continuously running the danger of being associated with crank, being called a crank.
Yes, I know.
And the answer to that, again, is to keep your head. That is the biggest problem, to keep your head while all around you are losing theirs and blaming it on you, you know.
Good heavens, you've been reading Kipling.
Oh, yes, I'm a great admirer of Kipling.
You're a great admirer of him?
Oh, yeah.
Tariq Ali and Edward Said. We're discussing great literature.
Yes.
And then they discussed Kim, and they seem to be mutual admirers of Kim. Can you believe it?
Yes.
I don't admire Kipling.
Well, no. Kipling wrote some beautiful poems. In fact, he was an imperialist and a racist.
Well, name one beautiful poem he wrote.
I think If is a beautiful poem.
Do you? It's not very beautiful.
Look, I've got there a whole lot of poems. I'll show you one someday.
So anyway, cancer is a possibility. What about schizophrenia, multiple sclerosis, Alzheimer's disease?
No. No, cancer is the main one I'm working on at the moment.
Radiation sickness?
No.
Pesticides, pollution?
But, cell division I'm also working on. I've got a theory of cell division. It's too late to go into it, but I think it's questionable that the current theory of cell division.
What with meiosis and mitosis and so on? Oh, right, with spindles and...
Yes, the spindle problem. I mentioned to you, the spindles are meant to pull the chromosomes to a pole, but since they're not attached to anything, they couldn't.
So there's some other mechanism.
Yes, and I'm trying to work out what that might be.
But how are you doing that? By going through the literature?
Yes, first of all, making an empirical theory and then going through the literature.
Do you find literature searches?
Oh, yes, very useful.
They're useful despite being disheartening.
But I don't do them on computers, I do them,
I mean, it must be a bit disheartening to see the same old stuff over and over again.
No, it is often. And
presumably there might be just one little clue tucked away that you could easily miss.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, like the nucleolus, for example.
But let me tell you...
You could have discovered the nucleolus by going through the literature, couldn't you, in principle. You just have
the nucleola membrane.
Yeah, but just by, you just have to.
Yes, but they. But I mean, the store. Those were drawings. You see, we've actually got photographs of it.
Yes, I know, but you could nevertheless have.
Yes, I could. I could have, but I mean, it's much more valuable to me to look down. And if you imagine, I showed it to people at the Physiological Society, and they said, "There's not a membrane there."
How do you know it was a membrane? You can just see the edge.
Because if you focus in and out, it's like a ball. You, it's in and out of focus.
Right.
But do you know what somebody said to me? Somebody said to me, well, you haven't shown that it's composed of lipids and proteins.
Yes, I know, yes. So that's a diversionary move,
exactly.
Isn't it?
Exactly. But I mean, it shows you how much, frankly, they dislike me. There was another occasion where my assistant produced some, I think it was quite beautiful work. She did a PhD, and she gave a paper to the Physiological Society, and they rejected it because I was a co-author.
Mm.
There were 25 people present, and they rejected it by 5-4.
The others abstained?
Yes, they usually abstain.
Why?
So they feel it's not their specialisation, so they don't express it.
So it's the easy way out as well, isn't it?
Well, yes, but I mean, it's also true that, for example, when people talk about kidneys, I know very little bit about kidneys, or genetics. So if it came to a vote, I would usually vote for the publication, because I don't know anything about it. If it was a bit fishy to me, I'd abstain. But it's not the central area of my knowledge, so I don't know whether it's right or not.
Do you know anybody else apart from Ling who's following the same paths as you are?
Well, there's a man called Schwaber. Now, Schwaber is a very interesting man. He's shown that Darwin was wrong.
Oh, this is a chap in America?
Yes.
Oh, with the two different evolutionary trees.
That's right. The evolutionary trees based on the biochemistry and on the zoology are different. And that's impossible.
So he's wrong, is he?
No, he's right.
So you're using these strange expressions again?
He's right.
Indeed. Mm. Yes, that's one of
his name is Christian Schwaber.
It's one of your stock examples, isn't it? Like this chap in Florence.
Yes.
You have discouragingly few stock examples, unfortunately.
Well, I wouldn't say that. There are very few people who are prepared to stick their necks out. I mean, this fellow, although he's a professor at the University of South Carolina, he'll never get anywhere.
Never.
Well?
Never in the whole of his life.
Yeah.
You've seen it happen before.
No, I have. There's a very nice man called Good who has a theory of muscle contraction, you see, and he absolutely slates the sliding filament hypothesis of Huxley and Hansen, you know, the current view on muscle. And he produced a beautiful book. And this book is based on the belief that the electron microscopy is correct, and it isn't. And I had a nice correspondence with him, but I didn't want to break his heart by telling him that I don't agree with the main elements of his hypothesis.
So why did you correspond with him?
Well, I wanted to examine his hypothesis. But I'm going to, when I write this paper or book on the muscle, I'm going to discuss it seriously. How many tapes have you taken?
There's two. Mm-hmm. Both 90-minute ones.
I see. Could you do me this little favour? I don't know if it's a little favour. If it's a big favour, and you haven't the time, don't do it. Could you possibly put this into a form which I could take it to the... actually, if you'd like, come with me. We'd go to the university and try to get it on the internet.
Now you mean?
No, not now. Well, it needs typing out first, I think. Yeah, I mean, can you put it on...
questions? Well, I could get it onto a disk, yeah.
Yes. Well, these are the questions. You did them before, you see.
Yes, I know. But you expect them not to be answered, don't you?
That's right.
Probably correctly.
Yeah, that's right. Then I forecast that, didn't I?
You can't do it. Provided I'm allowed to put as many insulting remarks in as I can to the readers.
No, you were answering.
To spur them on.
Oh, I see. No, you answer it. I mean, if you want to.
No, I don't mean that. I mean, can't I put in insulting comments? Like use spineless gibbs or something?
No. No, that's going too far.
Can I make them anonymous and put something like that in?
No, that's exactly the thing one must never do. In science, they're waiting for you to do that. They're waiting for you to insult them. They can say you're emotional, unbalanced, you know, crazy, you don't know the literature. They can say anything they like. There's a colleague of mine who buggered me at the university. You know what he did? He said that teaching wasn't my strongest point. Now, wasn't that brilliant?
You mean as a sort of review of your performance?
Yes.
It's not really nice then, was it?
It was malicious.
Was it true?
Well, I asked everybody who ran any course which I taught, and I had a big pile of 12 letters saying, I mean, one of the chap put it, wrote The Guardian, said it was one of the best teachers who'd ever taught him. I mean, it doesn't mean anything to one person, but I mean, I haven't, on the whole, I've got quite good, I mean, I get 100% attendance in the lectures when I used to go.
Wouldn't it sound?
That's right, but I mean, that's what I'm saying, you can say anything you like, can't you? If you get into emotional things, that's why I don't want to tell them they're a lot of spineless gits or crooks or anything like that. I mean, that's irrelevant, really. The questions aren't irrelevant.
It might be an attention-attracting device, is what I mean.
Yeah, no, it won't. It will just attract...
It might attract the wrong sort of attention.
The wrong sort of attention. It'll, and... It,